Hi, it's Leah. Today I'm speaking with Thomas Iden. Thomas is a nuclear engineer and the founder and CEO of Atomic Alchemy. His startup manufactures radioisotopes, which are used in nuclear medicine. That's a specialized area of radiology that is critical for diagnosing and treating diseases like cancer. However, as Thomas has previously worked at several national labs where he designed reactor cores, components, and the experiments to test them, our conversation mainly focuses on nuclear power. We cover everything from the bottlenecks for a nuclear renaissance, lost industrial knowledge, different perspectives on risk, and the wealth of possible futures powered by atomic energy. Without further ado, here's our conversation. So, Thomas, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
You run a startup, Atomic Alchemy. From a bird's eye view, where does your work fit into the nuclear field more broadly, and what granular problem are you trying to solve?
So nuclear technology is actually very broad. The one that's the part of it that's most commonly associated with nuclear is nuclear power. That's the most visible. What we're working on specifically is a subset of nuclear technology called radioisotopes, which is a fancy way of saying radioactive materials. And what's neat is that we have a wide variety of uses for these radioactive materials. And one of the most important is nuclear medicine. And so in essence, we're tackling a problem in nuclear medicine, namely access to these radioactive materials. And so, yeah, from a granular perspective, we are focusing on this discrete use of radioactive materials, whereas there's a much broader field of power, of space exploration, you name it.
And how's the landscape of nuclear isotope production looking like today? What are the most important efforts in your field right now?
So the landscape is actually not looking the greatest in that the world's supply of these materials primarily comes from a small number of aging nuclear reactors spread out around the world. And the key issue is that by being spread out around the world, being very far away from where they're mostly used, to put it in perspective, the United States consumes about 50% of the world's nuclear medicine each year. But we don't really make any of those radioactive materials. And so to get that material from, say, South Africa, Australia, Europe, over to here is very expensive because radioactive material disappears over time. It's radioactively decaying. And so the farther away your source of material, the more expensive it is to make because you have to make more of it. Likewise, these being old reactors, they're prone to shutting down because they're old and undergo maintenance issues. You have disruptions in the supply chain. And then on top of that, as they get too old and too expensive to maintain, their respective governments will shut them down eventually. And so the supply, the overall manufacturing capacity is dwindling as well as time goes on. And so there are some efforts in the world today to combat this. A lot of it has been a lot of talk and studying the problem and issuing recommendations and talking about it. And then there are a number of companies out there that are building some infrastructure to produce these materials in different ways. And then Atomic Alchemy is going up and saying, hey, we just need to build more reactors. We need to address the problem head on. We're going to build more nuclear reactors specifically designed to make these materials so that we can stabilize and improve the supply chain.
And why is this effort only happening now if this has been a problem for a long time?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question because I've known about this problem since I was in college. It's only been getting worse since then. But 10 years ago when I was in college, I was aware of this issue. There's, I think, two main reasons. One, it's not easy to design nuclear reactors. And in a sense, a lot of it today is done via modeling. We have special nuclear codes that we can use to model reactors. How do they work? How do they react in different situations, different operational modes? And it's very computationally intensive. And so problem number one is even 10 years ago, access to vast quantities of computing power wasn't easy. If I dig through my old Facebook photos 10 years ago, I built my first awesome gaming rig, which had one of the newest Core 2 Duos, like processors at a whopping 2 cores on them. Now you can buy them with 20 for a relatively cheap price. And so back then, in order to use these very computationally intensive codes that could easily guzzle thousands of cores, you know, it was just not possible. And you needed supercomputers or maybe a national laboratory support. Today, you can just either use Amazon AWS, buy a couple of server racks, and go to town. And so it's fundamentally easier and less expensive and quicker to do iterative reactor design work on a relatively low budget. I think the second issue is that nuclear isn't the biggest field, and entrepreneurship is not exactly the most widespread thing in the population. There's a small subset of people that make the jump. And when you have a small field and a small subset of those people making the jump, that's a recipe for there not being a lot of, I hesitate to use this phrase, but for lack of a better term, solution-oriented people. There are certainly a lot of super smart people in my field that kind of work on the problems they're given in a particular context. But there's not a whole lot of people out there willing to, say, quit a government lab job to go actually build a reactor. They're happy to participate in some way, in so much as a laboratory is participating. But very few people are willing to actually take the risk of leaving their very stable careers to go try to build a reactor in actuality. And it doesn't help that there are prevailing attitudes that it is too hard, or that you have to have the government fund it, or that it's not possible in some way. And there's a lot of negative reinforcement in this field, I believe, for encouraging people to actually go do it. And so I think those are the two main things.
Yeah, and I definitely want to touch upon that latter point later on. You had mentioned or alluded to it a little bit just now, but I am wondering in general, what do you think about skill succession and the transmission of tacit knowledge in the nuclear energy sector? You said that it's quite a small field and it seems to have shrunken definitely in the past few decades. So do we even have enough nuclear engineers and talent entering the field to enable a worldwide nuclear renaissance?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I hope my answer is not too controversial, but I think what people know but maybe don't point out is that, to be frank, ginormous national laboratories that do employ the vast majority of our nuclear engineers sometimes almost feels like a jobs program, because it does tie into that there is genuine desire in terms of, say, because the military does use nuclear propulsion in the Navy and such. So there is a national security issue in terms of having enough innate nuclear knowledge. And then I think the national labs are means of making sure that there is a retention of nuclear expertise. And certainly there's a certain amount of nuclear expertise in how to design reactors and the material science, and a lot of the other aspects that go into designing these systems. It's just that what we're lacking primarily these days is experience just actually building the things, which is why you see, it's like any technology, the first units are clunky, expensive, take a long time to build. And then as you start mass producing things, that widget, the cost comes down, you work the kinks out. But the last time we built a nuclear plant in this country, it was decades ago, and you're seeing a manifestation of those regrowing pains in, say, Plant Vogtle in Georgia. But I would say, yes, there is more than enough nuclear talent. It's actually surprising. The nuclear portion is usually the sort of easiest to fill, because it really only takes one or two nuclear engineers for really honing in on, say, a smaller reactor design on the scale of, say, our reactors at Atomic Alchemy. But what's really in demand is mechanical engineers, like those mechanical systems, and maybe even like how do those materials and mechanical systems in a reactor environment hold up? And so actually, I think a lot of the talent pool that we need with nuclear companies as mechanical engineers, because it's easy to fill up the nuclear portion. It's a very deterministic science. But yeah, to tie it all together with a bow, yeah, we do have the expertise and we are maintaining it, but there are some areas that are lacking that. And I don't think that in terms of skills is what's really going to hold back, say, a new nuclear renaissance. It's that entrepreneurship, where it's a completely different skill set. It's not engineering. It's storytelling. It's risk-taking. It's management. And so I think that's way more important than even the engineering aspect of it.
Makes sense. And what to you is the most fascinating idea in your field? What idea got you hooked and thinking that it is a promising field to work in, though it shrunk in size over the past decades and was like a pretty minor field when you started in college?
So when you're in high school, I felt like I did my diligence and studied, hey, what should I get into, for a high school student? But it definitely wasn't the same approach I'd take nowadays in terms of long-range planning. So I kind of more or less got into nuclear because I really enjoyed science and engineering and like STEM-related stuff. And nuclear just seemed like the coolest because it's like involving nucleus of atoms and nuclear reactions, all these particles that do weird things and quantum mechanics. And so it was more of a cool factor for like, yeah, this is a cool thing. But fortunately, even though it's very difficult, like in school with the mathematics involved, I just loved it enough that I stuck with it. Because, honestly, my second choice was like genetics. Like I thought, genetics, genetic modification, that kind of stuff, really fascinating. But nuclear was like, oh, this is really cool. And so it was more of a, it was a cool factor. It's hard to say that there's like a prevailing cool idea in the field in terms of like from a philosophic bent. I can definitely say it's really cool to think like when you're at a reactor console, hey, I'm manipulating the fundamental forces of nature. Now that's a cool idea. So
yeah, absolutely. And I want to like move it to the area of risk, our misconception of risk as it applies to the nuclear energy sector. So firstly, how do you think about nuclear energy risk? And how do you think that your framework for approaching this question might differ from that of a person acquainted with pop culture coverage of nuclear energy?
Yeah, nuclear definitely has an image problem right now. And a lot of that's actually stemmed from the fact that a lot of nuclear advocates always stress about how safe nuclear power is, which is in fact true. But would you feel comfortable flying an airplane where if every time you're walking down the tarmac, the flight attendants would come up to you and go, it's going to be a safe flight. It's going to be a safe flight. Trust us. It's going to be safe. And you're gonna be like, why do you keep telling me this? And so, are you sure? So there's almost like a huge PR problem in that just in terms of tackling the perception, it's usually done quite poorly. But we are seeing a perception shift because one, the last nuclear accident, that radiation from the accident actually killed someone, was some really poorly designed Soviet controlled reactor, what, almost 40, 50 years ago? And so, okay, if you don't like nuclear power because something bad happened 50 years ago, then you've got some logical issues there. And so you are seeing a bit of resurgence, though, with the question of climate change. Hey, we have several sources of power here that say, if I care about carbon dioxide, these sources don't emit carbon dioxide. And it's become abundantly clear that most of them are very intermittent and can't power a city by themselves. And then you have one left over where it's like, this thing's on 24/7, doesn't emit the things I don't like. And then we can stem these other problems. And then the question is, then how safe is it compared to other things? And then the track record is very clear from that point, just digging into the facts that from a deaths per unit of energy perspective, nuclear has by far the lowest. More people fall off of roofs doing rooftop solar than a radiological related death from a nuclear power plant. And so it's an industrial activity. So there will be workers whom will be killed in an industrial environment. It happens. But in terms of the general public, in the United States, since nuclear power became a thing back in the 50s, not a single American has died from the radiological portion of nuclear power in its entire span of existence. And I actually did a TEDx talk on this very thing in terms of risk perception. And I provocatively titled the talk, "Sex is More Dangerous Than Nuclear Power." Because more people have died having sex in the United States than in nuclear power. And you also can take a look at the fact that, as I mentioned, the United States Navy has nuclear reactors aboard their submarines and aircraft carriers. And then you have to remind yourself that the people running these reactors and these ginormous ships or these really, fascinating engineering marvels that we call submarines are run by effectively kids. You have someone coming out of high school, they go to nuclear power school for a few years, and now they are running multiple reactors on an aircraft carrier. So we've got millions of nautical miles of ships traversing the ocean without incident, especially from a radiological perspective. Yes, you know, there have been accidents where subs have sank and stuff like that, but you know, for how many miles that kids have taken military craft across the oceans, you don't hear about too many of these issues. And so it's just looking at those deaths per unit of energy, usually terawatt years, terawatt hours. Nuclear is by far the safest. The data is clear.
But so if you think that there is somewhat of an overemphasis that might actually be counterproductive, like people saying over and over again how safe it really is, and you can make like so many, you know, like cases for that, how would you change the PR then to be more effective?
Certainly, if someone is screaming that nuclear is not safe, it's then, yeah, you'll want to go point to the facts. But I think a very appropriate framework that the narrative has been shifting to is the fact that us as people require a lot of energy to have happy, healthy lives. We can definitely see the correlation between energy use in the developing world versus, say, Western countries and our varying lifestyles, and see it's clear more energy is better. It allows us to do more things, keep a cleaner human environment. And so even though it seems that initially, and this kind of concerned me back when it first started, that there was like a schism in the environmentalist movement where there were up and coming youngins who were like, hey, I think we actually think nuclear power is good, where you had the old guard that was like, hey, nuclear is bad at all costs, shut it down, sabotage it. You had the new guard coming in saying, actually, no, nuclear power is pretty good. And I was concerned at first that it was going to be solely on the basis of, hey, we need to mitigate climate change, because then you're saying, hey, nuclear is good only because of this bad thing. But I was happy to notice that the sort of pro-nuclear environmentalists were actually taking a more humanistic bent and not only saying, hey, no, we have a source of electricity that has less byproducts emitted directly into the environment, but they also took the bent of, you know, people, our way of life, our mortality rates, our standard of living is directly correlated to energy use. And so, yes, it's good that it stems this existential thing that is a problem, but we primarily want to have that standard of living. And by having that standard of living and that large amount of energy, we're able to make this other problem tolerable. We're able to stymie the issues of climate change by having abundant power. Because if we have a city like New York, it's much more easy to fend off issues that are climate related than a village in some sort of maybe Southeast Asian country that doesn't have electricity. You have a tsunami coming in the level of place, it's gone. You have a hurricane that devastates the Gulf of Mexico, it's a travesty. There's still a ton of damage, but we are much better able to cope with those issues by virtue of having abundant energy to deal with it. And so it's been really nice to see that there has actually been more of a humanistic bent to part of the schism of the environmentalist movement when talking about nuclear power. It's framed in more of a positive light.
Yeah. So I think it's safe to say that we are both pro-nuclear, but I'm very interested in understanding the opposite camp. What to you is the strongest argument you could make for an anti-nuclear attitude? And what would have to happen for you to find yourself as an adherent of that camp?
I think one of the best arguments that an anti-nuclear advocate has is not because it's not good because it's a legitimate argument. It's good because it's hard, in some cases, hard to answer. And that's, but what about the waste? And so nuclear waste is a big issue, but it's not a technical issue. It's a political issue, to be very clear. And, you know, it's funny because if you go dig down to the primary sources, if you go look at the writings of the early scientists and engineers who were foundational in developing nuclear power, that was one of their main concerns, is that we have this amazing technology and it makes some sort of byproduct material as any industrial activity does, but it just has this unique issue of that it's radioactive. And so how do we deal with these, say, spent nuclear fuel and other waste forms that have this not wonderful aspect to them? And so the early scientists and engineers, they already knew that this was going to be a thing. So a lot of early reactor designs were actually designed to take nuclear waste and use it. Some of the earliest designs were called breeder reactors that actually made more fuel than it burned, because they thought that we only had this much uranium in the world, and hey, if we don't have enough uranium, we can't have this wonderful source. So let's find a way to milk the fuel as long as we can. A lot of issues were thought of way before any of these people could even utter, "What about the waste?" So it's a political issue in that the government historically has really taken charge to take spent fuel and put it somewhere and lock it up underground where it, quote, can't hurt anybody. And they wanted to do it for millions of years. And then very recently, the government actually has failed to do so and has actually had to reimburse nuclear power companies on a tax levied upon them to pay for such a repository. And so the government actually had to reimburse for failing to do what it said it would do. So I think people have the perception that it is very dangerous. Like, nuclear waste is a very dangerous thing, primarily because of how much government involvement there is about it. But it's funny because you can, say, Google search dry cask storage or some other keyword related to nuclear waste. And all nuclear waste really is, at least let's talk about, let's say, nuclear fuel. All that is, it's a big hunk of metal that is radioactive that sits in either a pool of water or sits inside of a concrete cylinder for some time until we figure out something to do with it. And you can go up to it, and at least the ones that are above ground and out of the water pools, you can go up to them and go hug them because it's shielding, and it's designed appropriately to shield you from, you know, the radioactive fuel inside. But I say until we figure out what to do with it, we do know what to do with it. We can actually reprocess fuel. Right now, the United States' current fleet of nuclear power plants only uses 1 to 4% of the usable uranium in the fuel. I'm actually very against this geological repository stuff because you're taking very valuable material and locking it away far away when we can store it above ground for a few years and then repurpose it and make new fuel out of it. And there are some newer reactor designs that are taking advantage of the fact that you can recycle this fuel and turn it into more fuel. Use it again and again. But because of various political reasons and by extension regulatory issues, it's not easy in the United States. But if you look over at Europe, like France and some associated countries with nuclear power plants, they do reprocess fuel. It's not some novel thing. So they already do that. We know how to do it. We've known how to do it for decades. To answer that second part of your question, I'm not sure there is a way for me to find myself in the opposite camp because it's not really an issue. But I think, and maybe I'll digress here a little bit and come up with, say, a second issue. There's the issue of if something were to happen, like you've got a 15 megawatt power plant. I mean, these are ginormous machines. Let's say you do have an issue and you have a 3 mile island. It would be expensive to clean up. The company that owned the reactor would incur a severe financial penalty because their huge moneymaker power reactor is now gone and they're paying to clean it up. But coming from the argument of something big and bad could happen because these are big reactors, I can see that argument, but you still have to come back and pull in the context of what is safety. Safety is relative to other things. Planes are safer than cars. You have noun than other noun. And so you then have to say, okay, something big and bad could happen at a big power plant compared to what? So then we can compare it to like the Bhopal incident. I think that's how you pronounce it, in India. It was a chemical plant that had an accident and killed a lot of people and maimed a lot of people. But we don't say, hey, we should never use that particular chemical ever again, because that's not how life works. And so you have to look at other forms of energy, other industrial activities, and say, if this thing were to happen, how much worse could it be than those other things that already do happen in a non-zero probability? And then the fact of the matter is, we do have some numbers under the belt now. We have the United States' greatest reactor accident in history, 3 Mile Island, where absolutely nobody died. And in fact, nobody really received a meaningful radiation dose, at least from the public perspective. We have Fukushima, where a ginormous tsunami just completely leveled an entire coastline, killed thousands of people, and everyone's focus is on the power plant, which is a great injustice to those lost lives. But nobody died from the radiological portion of the Fukushima reactor. More people died from the traumatic evacuation out of fear. And then we have Chernobyl, which is unfair to even use as an example because, one, you could argue it wasn't even a civilian power plant. They were making grade materials in those reactors while supplying electricity to the Soviet public. But you also have a reactor that was poorly designed, never would have been, never was implemented in the West, and that is actually phased out from Russian fleet, at least in terms of building new ones, just because it was such a poor design. After the Chernobyl incident, the number of people that actually died from the radiological hazards, which was after the reactor melted down, was in the tens, and so directly from radiation. We do have to acknowledge that there were heightened incidents of thyroid cancer in the surrounding areas, but we can attribute that safely to the fact that, the Soviet government covered up the fact there was an accident. If there would have been fair warning ahead of time, hey, don't be eating the cows that are contaminated grass, a lot of that could have been mitigated. But does something like that say we should never, ever use this source of power ever again? Definitely not, especially since the existing Western designs and the newer reactor, there's always continuous improvement. Those kind of accidents simply can't occur in some of the new reactor designs we have out there. So, what would it take for me to kind of be in the other camp? I think we'd have to actually see this widespread destruction, because even amongst nuclear engineers, there's this, and I think it's mostly because of how regulated everything is, there's almost this reverence of fragility. You're always we have to have these 100 steps to perform this procedure because it's a reactor. But these reactors, they're designed to be very robust. It's really hard to, there's so much safety margin that's designed into them that you can maybe do something accidentally wrong and it's totally fine. It's designed to withstand that stuff. And so whenever you're sitting in front of the reactor console, I've operated a reactor before, you're like, wow, I don't want to touch the wrong button. This thing might go boom, which of course they can't, but you're afraid to destroy this multi-million dollar machine. But they're not that fragile. They feel fragile because of that almost the self-induced fear from how many steps there are in a procedure and how regular it is, but they're actually very robust. And if you think about it, with Fukushima, that tsunami leveled an entire coastline and entire towns. And one of the things that was actually still standing was the nuclear power plant, severely damaged, no doubt, but it was the only thing standing around it. And so it's just a testament. If people think Fukushima is a pockmark on nuclear power, and I actually think it's more of a testimony to the amazing work that nuclear engineers and mechanical engineers and plant designers do because of how robust these machines truly are. So even then, it's still hard to find myself in the opposite camp because it is so clear to me, and it's not because I'm a paid shill or because I have a stake in it, but because of working in this field, even beyond just having the fascination to get into the field in the first place, it is very obvious that the people that work in this field care so much and they do the best jobs they can to design the safest machines and effective machines that can power human civilization. And so it's the facts make it obvious.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Related to the previous questions, if you could wave a magic wand, what piece of information would you seek that could further strengthen your case? And what do you feel would be required for a yet more robust case for nuclear? You've been pretty convincing so far, but maybe there's one piece of information that's still if you could get data on it, you would actually really appreciate.
Well, I'll preface that my answer with I find it really funny because some people think we have short memories, but I remember just 10 years ago, I think they're calling it global warming at the time. Global warming is going to kill us all. We need to have more wind, more solar, more quote renewable energy, no matter the cost. We need to have all these government subsidies. We need to do whatever it takes. It doesn't matter. Money is not an issue because we're all going to die. And now that we've seen a more widespread adoption of wind power and solar power to the extent that they've manifested themselves due to these tax credits and direct subsidies, et cetera, now we're seeing some imbalance in the market where all of a sudden we're seeing nuclear plants shut down, which provide base load 24/7 electricity because they can't compete as well because it's an unlevel playing field. Nuclear is by far infinitely more regulated than solar and wind, in spite of having less deaths per unit energy. There's market distortion due to these subsidies and tax breaks and other incentivizations for investment. And so then now that there's this resurgence of thought of, hey, we know, you know, we don't like CO2, nuclear doesn't emit CO2, the common retort from the anti-nuclear folks is, well, it's just too expensive. They take too long to build. They're not a solution. And I'm sitting here like, well, I thought cost didn't matter. You know, what happened to the whole, oh, it doesn't matter. Now, apparently it's not your favorite source of energy. Apparently cost matters now. So I think in terms of if I had a magic wand, I would really love to see, because it's such a nebulous thing to argue about, because it is hard to get good data, is the economics. Because we know fairly well the economics of nuclear power. We know that the fuel is incredibly cheap. We have a good grasp of, with so many decades of operation, what operation and maintenance costs are. But what I don't think is really understood is the, say, cost of compliance. Regulation is not cheap. Nuclear is, in fact, I think, and I could be wrong, but to my knowledge, the only field that has to pay for its own regulation. So SpaceX does not pay the FAA to do reviews. Boom Supersonic does not pay the FAA to do reviews. A farm doesn't pay the FDA, or even like pharmaceutical companies don't pay the FDA for review of certain things. But nuclear pays probably around, I think the latest numbers are $278 an hour per NRC engineer to review documents. So if you're in a public meeting with five NRC staff members, take $278 times five times maybe 2 hours, and then I get that bill in the mail. So it's too expensive, of course, because if we submit a license application for a new reactor that takes several years to approve, that's 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, 2 to 3 years or longer, times maybe 10 staff members. Like, we're talking millions of dollars, and don't tell me that's fair, especially when you say, hey, nuclear is not economical. And so I would like to see the economics broke down a bit more as to what is the true cost of compliance for nuclear, because on top of what I just said too, you have the almost more nebulous issue that with radiation, we use a very outdated model called the linear no threshold hypothesis that basically says that anytime radiation transits your body, the risk of cancer linearly scales in proportion to your dose, and that risk never goes away. And so I think we're the only field that also has a model, such model, because even like in, say, toxicology and your chemical based biology, it's like, yeah, if you like dump a bunch of poison onto something, you're going to kill it. If you give it a very small dose of poison, sometimes those biological mechanisms can cope with it and then heal itself. Our bodies can heal after being exposed to radiation, but that's not accounted for in the regulatory models. And so nuclear is also held to an extremely conservative notion that any amount of radiation is a risk to your health and does not go away for your entire life. And so it's actually, I think the analogy, I think it's hilarious. It's like saying, if you jump off a 40-foot building, you pretty much fall and splat and die. But according to linear no threshold hypothesis, if you jump 1 foot down steps until you go down all 40 stories, you also die, because that, quote, falling every foot accumulates over time and adds up until you die. And so it's literally the basis for a lot of nuclear regulation in terms of radiation protection, in terms of how you design things to mitigate radiation exposure. Power companies spend millions of dollars to shave off tiny amounts of radiation exposure to routine maintenance and operations, because the prevailing philosophy is as low as reasonably achievable. But the key is what's reasonable. And so it's really hard to parse out why are certain things so expensive or time consuming, or even just something as lofty as, hey, we're spending extra time designing things to mitigate this thing that may not actually be as bad as the models that we currently use suggest. And so my magic wand would be, let's find out what's the cost of compliance and how much that really drags down the economics of nuclear, so that you can't compete with these other subsidized forms of intermittent energy.
Yeah. And how is it justified that nuclear has to pay for its own, you know, regulatory work, whereas other sectors don't? That just seems blatantly unfair.
There's some history to that I'm not as familiar with. I've talked about it with some friends in passing, but I don't have enough upfront knowledge of how it came to be that way to give you a good answer.
All right.
But there's a historical reason, and it's becoming obvious that it's not the way to go. I will say this. It ties into the fact that the part of it has to do with the NRC as an independent regulatory agency. So whereas the EPA, FDA, OSHA, whatever alphabet soup agency you can think of, typically falls under the executive branch and is beholden to things like executive orders. You see this with, say, vaccine mandates for employers with 100 people or more. That's being enforced through OSHA. So executive order translates into regulatory action. The NRC is an independent regulatory agency that is only beholden to acts of Congress. So if you want to change the regulation, you need a new law to change the regulation. So whatever president is currently sitting can't just go, I don't like nuclear. Here's some executive orders to add all this regulation and shut everything down. That's not possible. The NRC can basically tell the president to go pound sand. And so that's part of it. That's part of in sort of the inception of the NRC. When the Atomic Energy Commission was broken up, it ties into that. And so when the NRC was formed, there was some provision, I think, like I said, I don't know enough to give you a good answer here, but basically the nuclear industry provides like 90-95% of the NRC's budget, and they receive just a nominal amount from the federal government as a result. And so you've got this weird issue too, where the fees, so of course you get charged for regulatory reviews, for audits, for anything that is an NRC person looking at your stuff, but you also get a flat fee every year, especially nuclear power plants receive a flat fee every year for the privilege of being regulated, regardless of whether there's any regulatory action or not. And those fees scale with how many nuclear plants there are, because if the NRC has a $1 billion budget and the number of fee-paying reactors goes down, then the share of remaining fees gets spread to the existing plants. And so as more plants shut down, it's actually getting worse that they're having to pay higher fees. And it's actually agnostic as to the power level of those facilities. So actually wearing their shirt right now, like Oklo here has designed a 1.5 megawatt electric microreactor. They get the same annual multi-million, they would receive the same multi-million dollar annual fee, regardless of anything, that a 1,500 megawatt reactor would. So it's like ridiculous. There's actually a lot of reform that needs to happen for nuclear to really take off, because the paradigm just really sucks right now.
And we have touched upon regulative strangulation quite a bit right now. But what problem do you see as the most upstream to faster progress in nuclear? I would think it's probably pretty high up there. But is it also a matter of culture, technology, or something yet different that has an important role to play?
So certainly, like with a lot of my activism in college and kind of my thinking now, I always thought that it was primarily just regulation, and certainly is a huge aspect, as I just pointed out. But it also turns out too that sometimes, in a lot of cases like right now, a lot of the times it's the folks constructing the plants also have issues in terms of management. So like a lot of, you see in the news VC Summer, a pair of AP1000 power plants, I don't remember his title exactly, but one of the head honchos of that utility went to jail because of fraud, essentially, of misleading investors as to the progress of the plant construction. And you see a lot of management issues in constructing these plants as well. And it's not necessarily because we suck. It's that these 15 megawatt reactors are very large construction projects, like very large construction projects. And if you don't do it for 30 years, then you're up and like, okay, let's do this. It's not that easy. So there's a lot of, whether it's because of some sort of bad trait of the company or whether it's just really hard work to do and we have a lot of lessons to relearn that we learned in the 50s but lost because we haven't built nuclear plants in 30 years. The flip side of the regulatory burden is that there's just a lot of issues in constructing these things, especially with the additional regulatory requirements. You can't just take some mom and pop company that builds houses or commercial office space and just be like, here, build a nuclear plant. the quality assurance requirements are so different and so much more rigorous that it takes a lot of extra training and a lot of extra being careful to do things right, because there have been instances where the contractor did the thing not quite to the quality assurance requirements, and the NRC ordered them to basically rip it out and do it all over again. I think the crux is that there's a lot of relearning that needs to be done in terms of nuclear plant construction that is also tied in with regulatory burden of constructing those plants.
Yeah, we do seem to have lost a lot of industrial capacity or expertise over the last few decades. You do seem to have somewhat of a good understanding of the legislative landscape surrounding nuclear also through your own work. Would you be able to place a lot of the slowdown of progress within a few distinct laws, or was it almost like a creeping, imperceptible process that ultimately resulted in paralysis due to bureaucracy?
I would say it's mostly a creepy thing. There hasn't been a lot of legislation recently that I could identify as like being bad for nuclear. There hasn't been a lot of legislation at all. But I think we can, and it's a complicated topic. I don't really want to get too much into it because it's really very complicated. It could take up another 2 hours of conversation. But you can really see that, especially like in the 70s with Three Mile Island, and then a decade later, you've got the double whammy of Chernobyl occurring, that the regulatory ratchet only goes one way. And after Three Mile Island, there were a heap of regulations that were added to pretend like we're never going to have an industrial accident at a nuclear facility ever again. And so things got much more expensive and onerous during and after the 70s in terms of that regulatory ratchet ramping up. And with very few exception, there's always tweaks and changes and additions to regulations, and you never really see regulation go away. And so I would say it's more of a creeping thing. Over the decades, you see more regulation added for whatever reason. Sometimes we're bored and need to figure out something else to do. Oh, here's an interesting issue I never thought of. Hey, let's study it. Oh, geez, this could possibly happen. Oh, we need to add some more regulation so that hypothetical thing could possibly not happen. And so it always ratchets one way. And it's over the decades creeping. And then you see another bump of additional regulation added to the full spectrum of things that need to be done to license and build a plant after Fukushima. Mm-hmm. And it's funny too, because you've got nuclear plants that are not on the ocean that have to comply with Fukushima regs that primarily address interesting issues like a tidal wave smashing an entire plant. But a lot of the extra redundancy that was required after Fukushima then went to places that don't really have extremely traumatic climactic events like hurricanes or tidal waves. Mm-hmm. But it's prescriptive and flat across the whole fleet, regardless of the actual environmental dangers to the facility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am also really curious. This is a little bit of a tangent, but we touched upon it as well, whether it's kind of the lack of progress in nuclear is a matter of regulation versus also a matter of ideas. And you have quite a bit of experience in academia. I'm curious whether you could address the academic climate in research universities nowadays, especially in technical disciplines. Are there problems with freedom of speech that make it maybe out of the humanities department and permeate even STEM? Or have you observed potential misaligned incentives in the way academia is run and funded? And lastly, maybe, how would you remake it?
Well, I can't really speak to it now. Things have certainly changed. I was in college 10 years ago, or when I was a university student doing graduate research. That was almost 10 years ago. And things were pretty okay then. A lot of this interesting things you see in the news regarding free speech or other activism on campuses, I was largely insulated from over in engineering. We just wanted to do our engineering thing. But I can imagine things are different nowadays. But I just have not been in that sphere for so long. A lot of my other academic experience, so to speak, would be having worked at a national lab. But in terms of being on campus, can't speak to that now. But at least when I was there, a lot of research that is done at universities is typically quite aligned with either what's in the research pipeline as informed by a national laboratory or by industry. Sometimes they're both one and the same, because a lot of the times universities are used for early research and to say, hey, what if we use this as a fuel? We want to make something better. And typically, a lot of the early dirty work is done inexpensively by contracting it through universities with cheap student labor, whom are happy to be at the forefront of research. But a lot of it's very preliminary and is for down selection. So, hey, you get 10 materials, and then the university research will indicate that, hey, these three things are promising. And then that research gets funneled downward even more to, say, the National Laboratory, where we have an actual, like, very large reactor to do the real experiments, where a lot of my research on nuclear fuels, I used in a particle accelerator to simulate a reactor environment. I created particle damage in fuel a surrogate way to get a sense of, okay, these ones are, this type of fuel is obviously no good. And then the stuff that seems promising then goes to the more expensive institutions for the more thorough testing. So there is a fair amount of alignment between industry and labs and universities in terms of the research. And yeah, as far as I am aware, I have no problem with how that paradigm works. There isn't a whole lot of cultural issues permeating whether this material has great salt corrosion for advanced reactor technologies. I have not seen that play too much of a role yet. That's one of the beautiful things about engineering, is that in terms of, you know, you mentioned free speech, there's no issue of you going, hey, this material kind of sucks at corrosion control. Because it's really hard to hide that. It's obvious that the science doesn't lie. These results are obviously showing that this material corrodes. It's probably not a good material for these molten salt-based reactor technologies. So fortunately, it's hard to have a free speech issue in engineering to an extent.
Yeah. I was more curious about how freely, I guess, you can speak about very bold proposals and bold ideas, how receptive people are still to moonshots, or how much there's like an incrementalism kind of permeating research universities these days.
In that regard, a lot of nuclear research, barring stuff that directly ties into, quote, advanced reactors, or I should say research over the last several decades, has been very incremental. Because if you're not building more reactors, then you're focusing on making the ones you have better than they are. And so you have decades of incremental research on, say, how do we squeeze every last joule of energy out of this nuclear fuel before it is in fact spent, until we reprocess it. So yeah, the last few decades, you could say it's been very incremental in the grand scheme of things. Certainly there have always been a research project here and there where they try to push the boundaries. But ultimately, up until recently, you could say that a lot of it's just been relegated to the filing cabinet. And so where you do have this slight resurgence in companies pioneering reactor designs that say don't use water for coolant, a lot of that work that had been pioneered in the 1960s is now actually coming to the forefront. And so a lot of historical stuff was incremental, but now I would say after Fukushima, a lot of national laboratory attention was redirected to what's called, quote, accident tolerant fuel. So there was a lot of research done, almost probably more on the incremental side, to say make existing nuclear power fuel more resilient to these types of natural disasters, to really lengthen the time of these accidents, to allow us to respond better and mitigate damage. And very recently, we're now seeing those campaigns being completed and there being a redirection of focus to these advanced reactor technologies, because there are a number of commercial entities pushing for their construction and making progress, and then doing now incremental, hey, let's make these preliminary technologies better and more useful and economically productive.
And so what are the trends that you think will keep on growing? What do you think is promising in the next 10 to 20 years? And where will the world more broadly move in your vision, influenced by nuclear?
That's a tough question because, you know, we're still seeing plants shut down. We're still seeing shaky economics due to policy issues. And so I still think nuclear is yet to really hit its trough. And then it'll be really hard to claw ourselves out of that trough, because when you don't build plants for a long time, you have to relearn those experiences. When your supply chain is now significantly reduced, because if you're not actively building plants, that supply chain with those, you know, that training for those enhanced quality assurance requirements, a lot of that talent evaporates or gets consolidated. Now you have two companies that can supply this pump. They're going to charge you 10 times the amount of money where you could have bought that pump on Amazon for 10 times less, but it's got the nuclear quality seal of approval on it. So they can just put you through the ringer because you don't have any other options. And so there's going to be a long climb out of the trough to build new plants, just because of basically we're just developing it all from the ground up again. There are existing nuclear contractors that have historically built plants, but you know, you got to be careful because they say they have nuclear expertise, and you know, maybe they help certain companies maintain their nuclear facilities, or they're actively involved in some of the meager construction that's happening. Not to say small, meager isn't small, but like the two plants we are actually building, but oh, they charge you an arm and a leg for that. They charge you an arm and a leg. And you have the additional problems of, you know, they're still stuck in the ways of this is how we did it in the 70s. If those people are still working, this is how we did it back in the day. So therefore, this is still how we know how to do it. And so yeah, that mindset too. So it's a long climb out of that trough.
Yeah, somewhat of a legacy bias there. How would you say can young people help? What would you want someone just starting out to know? And which resources perhaps would you recommend?
There's a very tiny number of nuclear startups. And so in terms of getting a job in nuclear, there are two places you can go. You can either be in academia at a university, you get your PhD and you do research, or you go to a national laboratory and do research, or you go work at a nuclear power plant and do industry, or at a nuclear facility, you know, doing some sort of aspect of industry. So that's where you get a job in nuclear. And so unless you're one of the few talented folks that gets into a startup, or you go start your own company, that's your options, really. And so in terms of resources, if you want to learn what it's, you know, like to do nuclear engineering, man, I mean, I never really thought about this because it's like I've lived it for so long. I would say there's a couple of things out there. There's an acquaintance of mine who runs a website called What is Nuclear? That's a really good place to learn about what are nuclear reactors, what are the types of nuclear reactors, what's the underlying physics for the different types of reactors, what physics are these different types of reactors taking advantage of. You can always go to the NRC's website if you want to go read thousands of pages of regulation. That's fun. That really helps with the bedtime stories. But yeah, I guess it really depends on what you want to do, because then if you're interested in, say, nuclear medicine, more aptly to what I'm working on, you can go to, say, like the Society of Nuclear Medicine or American Nuclear Society or some of these other trade groups, and they have materials that you can find, some outreach materials that kind of give you a sense of this is what it's about. Yeah. But really the best way is to, like, if you're at a university that has a nuclear program, not everyone does, but there are a number of nuclear programs around the country at universities where the university has a research reactor on campus. Even if you're not an engineer and you don't want to do engineering, more often than not, they have a program where you can take a class where you get to operate that reactor. You get to train on the systems, learn how all of the systems work together. Like, this is a cooling loop. This is a water cleanup system with a resin bed. This is a control console. These buttons do that. And you get to actually operate the reactor. And at least at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I went to school, we had that class, and that was open to anybody. It didn't matter what your major was. It wasn't just for the nuclear engineering program. So even if you're like in the humanities, it's still a really cool class to take, because yeah, there's a little bit of math involved, not crazy math for those kind of classes, but you get to operate and see for yourself, hey, this isn't scary. Like, you get to operate it yourself. This is a very manageable, cool technology.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's the best way to learn about it.
Absolutely, yeah. So what is the implicit knowledge in your field that you feel generally holds true but is not explicitly stated? What has to be learned anew through experience by everyone entering the field with no real reason, like it could be written down or shared more publicly?
I am not sure how to answer that one. I would say the closest way to answering that would be, like, in school, a lot of our classes were geared towards power reactors, because 95% of reactors out there are for power, or people that are going into industry are going to be at a power plant. But in terms of how nuclear reactors work and different core designs and how different materials affect how the reactors operate, I think the closest way to answer that question is when I got out of school and then worked at a non-power research reactor, a lot of what I learned in terms of how power plants work didn't hold true, because this was a fundamentally different core design. And so there were a lot of really neat nuances I got to learn that we just didn't cover because they weren't applicable or relevant to power reactors. And so I was like, why is this weird thing happening? My model says this, and the reactor is doing that. I don't get it. And then you dig into it and go, oh, I didn't account for this, that now that it's been told to me or I've figured it out, makes sense, but I never would have really thought of that. And so, I mean, I have some technical examples But there was some learning experiences where it's, oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. That's really cool that we didn't learn that in school. It's more technical stuff, I would say.
Between you and the people you work with or are closest to, what's the most contentious theme that seems to repeat itself when you're discussing your problem?
Probably the role of regulation. Especially when I was in school, it was interesting that I think I was one of the few people who was actively vocal about maybe there's too much regulation. Maybe there's a little too much. I often got the eye roll because I would be like, hey, here's a plan for privatizing spent fuel storage. And then I get the eye roll of, no, it's a government's job and stuff like that. And so, I mean, there's a fair number of nuclear engineers out there that think that we need this much regulation. My retort always was, if you think that you need the government to hold your hand that badly, maybe you shouldn't be in this field. I don't want you operating my reactor. But within the field, I think there's a big difference in opinion on what or how much regulation there should be. And I would say maybe a lesser extent. You could maybe argue that everyone's got their favorite reactor design. And hey, if we're building more reactors, we should build this one versus that one.
Right.
Yeah. It's really all very, I think, in terms of contention, it's all varying degrees of people's views on regulation or maybe how dangerous radiation is.
What have you become more skeptical of in the past 10 years? And what have you become more confident and convinced of? And this could even go outside of just nuclear energy.
I've actually become, at least when I was in college, I distinctly remember the American Nuclear Society, the universities, everyone in the field was like, we've got the new nuclear renaissance. It's all coming back, baby. And we're all hyped. We're going into this field with, hey, we're going to build all these reactors. It's going to be great. And then a bunch of reactors shut down and none were being built. And so in terms of what have I become less confident in is, I would say my less confident and more confident thing are one and the same. I'm less confident that things are going to necessarily be better sooner, but I'm also seeing things to indicate that there's light at the end of the tunnel in terms of us building more reactors and doing it right. And, you know, I'm not in the power side of nuclear right now, but I always give a shout out to like my fellow startups that are the ones I think are going to pave the way for the new nuclear renaissance, because it's the efforts of the nuclear startups. And I say startup in the startup sense. I'm more skeptical of the quote startups that say, hey, we need $100-200 million government dollars in order to do this thing. That's not the future, I don't think. But there are a number of startups that are forging their own path without government money that are going to really tackle the regulations head on, get something built, and then build off of that experience and that foundation. And so I guess to wrap that question up is, I'm much more skeptical nowadays of progress because so many people have told me that they're going to build this newfangled thing, there's the renaissance here, and none of it's ever panned out. And so I'm more of a, I'll believe it when I see it guy. But I've also seen some of the progress being made, and it gives me tremendous hope and confidence that things are going to be reversing. Just it's going to take a few years for some of these startups to hit their traction and then take off.
Yeah. And what's something nobody will tell me that I should know? What's something you discovered in your life that society or employers or friends conceal that's important to know?
Sex is more dangerous than nuclear power. Yeah, it's that risk. I'd have to think about that one. What's something that no one ever told me? I this is like a half answer because I don't really have a good one, because it's I don't think it's any different than any other field where it's like, ooh, I'm going to get into this biology field and it's going to be awesome. And then they have to take O-chem and they're like, I hate this. It's so hard because O-chem really sucks. But it's more along those lines of there's just certain aspects where you learn that it's just really hard. Or I think I would say like a recruiter for a national lab isn't going to tell you like, oh, by the way, you're going to do some really cool science, but there's also a lot of bureaucratic paperwork. You're going to love it. So it's just like any job. It's like anything. There is always a thing, an aspect where it's just like, that's not my favorite. And there are in a lot of nuclear institutions, there's a lot of bureaucracy and nobody stresses that up front. To have a little fun with this question too is, nobody told me there would be so damn many acronyms. Nuclear engineers love their acronyms. We like to make up acronyms. We like to make contrived acronyms. And sometimes there's nested acronyms with acronyms in them. And so no one told me that. And I now very much hate acronyms. There's so many of them. Idaho National Lab has its own like internal website with the 15,000 acronyms and what they mean. It's ridiculous. So it's an industry thing. I'm not picking on the laboratory, but it's a struggle within the industry.
Right. Maybe lastly, what don't I know that I don't know? What important questions have I not asked of you today?
What don't you know? I think maybe a fun thing you did not ask me today is what are all the different uses of nuclear technology? And, you know, we've talked a lot about nuclear power. We briefly mentioned my startup, which is building nuclear reactors to produce radioactive materials for nuclear medicine. Radioactive materials can also be used for many industrial purposes, gauges, sensors, a neat thing called radiography, where you use radiation to make a picture. It's like x-rays, but just a different type of radiation. One of my favorite technologies is the radioisotope thermal electric generator. So if you think of two rovers driving around on Mars right now, if you think of the Cassini probes, the Voyager probes now in interstellar space, the Pluto New Horizons probe that took those fascinating pictures of Pluto, those were all powered by radioisotopes. We have little devices that can convert the decay heat from radioisotopes decaying directly into electricity. And so we power those deep space missions. Wherever the sun don't shine, you use nuclear power. And, you know, we can do fascinating space exploration. I mentioned we can use neutrons to change silicon to make it a better semiconductor. So we can irradiate silicon and make better semiconductors. The opportunities are boundless. Even taking nuclear power, what are the applications of nuclear power? Yeah, there's electricity, but in a world with less regulation, we would have nuclear-powered cargo ships that would never have to be refueled. We could have desalination plants where Israel employs desalination a lot. I don't believe they use nuclear to do it, but you literally could turn desert countries into tropical paradises by desalinating the ocean water. It's funny, you have California constantly, you see in the news, drought, which, you know, California is a desert that we've turned into a paradise. And it's next to the largest body of water in the world. We can turn the Pacific Ocean into a giant hunk of fresh water. Not the whole thing, but we can use reactors to refill the lakes that are under drought conditions. Space nuclear is really exciting. Beyond those radioisotope batteries, reactors in space for powering moon bases, Mars bases, instead of little batteries, reactor-powered probes that we could maybe have orbit Pluto and study it rather than just fly by. So there's so many applications for just nuclear power, its versatility, its power, and because it's so power dense, small reactors to do really cool things in tight places.
I hope that will grow in salience for the general public, that it is really an exciting future that could be made possible by nuclear power and nuclear more broadly. Thank you so much for taking the time today. It was a pleasure speaking. I learned a ton, and we'll link to everything in the show notes.
Yeah, it was fun. It's really fun to just talk about the potential of this stuff, to reignite the imaginations of people going, oh, that's possible, huh?
Absolutely.
Why aren't we doing it?
So, that's what it takes.
Yeah, appreciate the questions.
Thank you so much, Thomas.
Thank you.